Hello and welcome to the Majlis, a podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. Shanghai Cooperation Organization is expanding and its new members are India and Pakistan. With new members on board, the organization represents nearly 40% of humanity and over 20% of global budget. While the expansion is impressive, it also raises so many questions in so many levels, including the future role of its smaller Central Asian members in the alliance. In the meantime, with so many rival projects underway in its target region, competing nations joining, and the fact that the organization is anyway portrayed a little more than a talking shop for China and Russia, what future holds for this organization going forward? This is our topic for this episode of Majlis. To discuss the subject, I'm joined by Jacob Zinn, Eurasian analyst for the Jamestown Foundation, who's also non-resident research fellow at the China's Shanghai Cooperation Organization Studies Center. Alex Melikishvili, senior Central Asia analyst at HIS Market Country Risk. Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlok Owozi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's blog focusing on Central Asia. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, and very nice to have you. Okay, with this, Jacob, let's start with you. India and Pakistan officially on board. What does adding these two nations do for Shanghai Cooperation Organization?
Well, it's clear that on the downside, these two countries are rivals, so it could affect the overall ability of the organization to come to consensus. But then again, the SCO is not an entity like ASEAN in Southeast Asia, which relies on consensus. The SCO is largely a Chinese initiative. Russia's obviously a big power. So they likely are able to overcome the fact that these two countries are rivals. But what they do bring to the table that is in accord with the rest of the countries, including China and Russia, is that they're very much against sort of what they consider the regime change programs coming from the West. And even though India is a democracy and the world's largest one at that, it also holds very similar views to China and Russia about not destabilizing regimes, even if they're considered autocratic or dictatorships. So I think that having these two countries can help the SCO work on that particular issue. And by bringing in these two countries that have about 1.5 billion people altogether, as you mentioned in your introduction, it makes the SCO a huge organization in terms of the population it holds. Mm. And at a time when NATO's future is questionable, it makes the SCO possibly the most powerful international security organization.
Okay, SCO has lots of its own problems, not to mention. But so what the Pakistan and India is hoping to gain from this membership?
Well, for India, at least, it and for Pakistan, it's sort of them playing each other against each other in a balance of power sort of way. I mean, China wants Pakistan in it because of its security relations, and that obviously wouldn't work out if India didn't join. So then India is joining because Pakistan joined, and then Russia sees India as a balance, against China in it. So I look at this more of a balance of power play, and Pakistan being the major factor because China needed Pakistan in it. But for India, it does have a lot of security interests in Afghanistan. And in that regard, it is interested in increasing its relationships with Central Asian countries, like the five stands. So it does allow India to get more of a footprint into that region as well. So you can find upsides in that regard for India, too.
Mm. So in other words, it sounds like joining of these two countries itself is a result of another rivalry. But going forward, where does the expansion of the organization put smaller members in Central Asia, Bruce?
Well, I mean, really from the start, when it was way back when it was the Shanghai Five, it was kind of obvious that Russia and China were really going to run this show, and that Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan were pretty much included just because of their geographic positions on the map. But that said, I mean, they have made it, it must be comforting for them to have partners in an organization like this that are as big as Russia and China, major powers, military powers. It does give them a little bit, I don't know, kind of like having a big dog or something that you can bring out whenever you you feel threatened or something. And we've seen that after Uzbekistan got in, that Uzbekistan would turn to them for help when they, or at least support, moral support, when they had problems with the West. But I would imagine now that after this, Kazakhstan probably come out, about the same, because it's an important country and it's right there on the border. It had long border with Russia, long border with China. Uzbekistan, because it's got a new leader, will probably still have a fairly good voice. They'll want to know what's happening in Uzbekistan and try to engage with them within the SCO and outside the SCO as much as possible. But if I was Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, I would have to think that, even being a junior partner would be perhaps a little bit flattering those two countries. I don't think they're going to have a lot of say in what's going to go on. They might profit from the relationship, certainly economically, first of all, I would imagine, and in Tajikistan's case, probably in terms of some security help. But I would think that really proposals that come out of Dushanbe and Bishkek probably get cursory review from the organization, especially if any of the big partners, China, Russia, India, and some extent Pakistan, don't really see eye to eye with what Dushanbe or Bishkek are saying. I would imagine they'll just all practically ignore them.
Alex, so with the two additional nuclear states on board, what changes should we expect in priorities of the organization going forward?
Shanghai Cooperation Organization is aptly named Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So I view it as a largely Chinese-driven initiative in which Russia played sort of a second balancing role. But I have to say that with regard to the incorporation of India and Pakistan, India's approach has been completely inconsistent. And what I'm referring to is the fact that India demonstratively did not show up for the OBOR One Belt, One Road summit in Beijing. Mm-hmm. Now, it seems rather puzzling for India to be so eager to join the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. But I have to agree with the previous speaker with regard to this tandem. It balances each other out because you have a tandem of Russia and India, and you have a China and Pakistan. So it made perfect sense. With regard to the Central Asian countries, Uzbekistan, I have to say, under Islam Karimov, objected at the time to the initiative, which was actually the initiative to join the India and Pakistan, was first voiced in 2015. Please correct me if I'm wrong. So it took roughly 2 years for this decision to be kind of to materialize. But Karimov objected precisely because of the fact that the nature of the organization was changing, tilting in the direction of members of the very exclusive nuclear power club. I'm talking about possession of nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
Because clearly you have China and Russia, now you have addition of two more. So four countries are also happen to be members of the nuclear weapons club.
Yeah.
Now that changes a great deal. Now we have to remember that this is a primarily security-oriented organization that is supposed to fight three evils of terrorism, separatism, and extremism. And actually, to answer your question directly, the degree to which Shanghai Cooperation Organization is effective will be seen in, let's say, one example would be stabilization of the India-China border disagreement. That will be a very good litmus test. Or between India and Pakistan. I mean, Shanghai Cooperation Organization will be seen as one of the forums where those issues of Jammu and Kashmir would be, I would assume, discussed, and that would show us also the how efficient it is in conflict resolution between those powers, between India and China, with regard to territorial issues on the border, and between India and Pakistan. Those are two primary litmus tests that I see to gauge the efficiency of this organization.
Let's expand on the security aspect of the organization. Jacob, in his speech in Astana gathering, Putin was warning of an IS plan to destabilize Central Asia. Some Central Asian leaders are increasingly talking about security threats. Does this mean more emphasis on security going forward?
I think there is definitely a chance for more emphasis on security going forward. IS doesn't really have that huge of a presence in Afghanistan, say, compared to the Taliban in Afghanistan. but it is enough of a player to have an influence on the countries in the organization. For example, IS just claimed killing some Chinese hostages in Pakistan. Right. So it can be very disruptive, and it can carry out big attacks in Kabul. And there are a number of Central Asians who have went to Syria and joined up with IS. And just as you see IS members going back to Europe and causing havoc, it is in the realm of possibility that they can make it back to Central Asia and do the same. Central Asia is obviously a lot more security conscious and very tightly run, so it makes it difficult. But but these countries could work together on the issue of, say, ISIS returnees in a way that they wouldn't be able to if they were not united on this, bringing in India and Pakistan.
You said the member countries could work together. How does security arrangement will look like then? Should we expect the Chinese soldiers patrolling on the Turkmen-Afghan border?
I wouldn't think that in the short term. It's more likely Russia would take on that role, because this is the type of arrangement between China and Russia where it seems like China could respect Russia's turf. And that's one of the ways that this can work out for both of these big powers in the organization. But I see it, at least in the short term, working more in principle. And if you look at the issue of extremism, for example, in the recent attacks in the UK, you had two individuals, one of whom was on a TV show as an ISIS supporter and one of whom said he wanted to be a terrorist and then was let go. Now, in the Central Asian context, both of those people would probably be in prison very quickly. And that's because in the SCO sphere, extremism is one of three evils, and that gets you in prison. Whereas in the European context, just having extremist thoughts does not do that, because it can become a slippery slope. So I think SCO countries now, by signing up to this terrorism, extremism, and separatism concept in principle, and now bringing on Pakistan and India aboard, can give greater legitimacy to their efforts to basically imprison extremists. And that could allow them to sort of shield themselves from pressure that often comes from the West about them imprisoning, say, extremists that tend to have more of a political inclination than, say, terrorist inclination.
Bruce, the likely emphasis of CSO on security going forward, if this is a possibility, how will this sound in Central Asia?
They're always happy to have this any extra help they can with security. But, you know, beyond intelligence sharing, I've never really seen that the SCO played much of a factor in security. And, you know, most of the deals that go on with the Central Asian states are bilateral. The Chinese help out in their own way, you know, Tajikistan, for instance, and Russia is leading the Collective Security Treaty Organization, and so they have their own game that they're playing out there. And the SCO as an organization itself, like I said, as far as intelligence sharing and a few other things that are more behind the scene, yes, but as far as an actual military presence on the ground in a time of crisis or something, they've run some exercises, but I don't see that it would ever be a factor in something like that. If there really was a threat in Central Asia that broke out and it was, you know, Islamic extremism or something like that, I think the Central Asians would resort to other alliances that they have long before they would ever hope to get any help from the SCO.
Alex, do you want to add something on this?
Yeah, I have to agree completely with Bruce, because, you know, SCO is institutionally underdeveloped. You know, it has it's largely a pro forma forums that gather every once in a while. The only sort of tangible thing that I can think of is regional anti-terrorist structure, which is headquartered in Uzbekistan, quite interestingly and intriguingly. But, you know, other than, I absolutely agree there, other than few sort of joint military exercises, I have yet to see anything sort of tangible. Moreover, it's beset by internal disagreements. And one practical example was Chinese initiative to form a bank under the SCO, which actually Russia resisted. And today at the summit of the heads of state in Astana, Kyrgyz president brought up again support for this initiative to form a bank, which will be very interesting to see how this issue is resolved now with two new members.
Okay. Regardless, in our part of the world, we say bigger is the better. So now CSO is bigger in scope, in size, and in strength. But regardless, does this organization matter at all? What it is past, tell us about its future. We will continue the discussion talking about these and many other questions shortly. Hey everyone, before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like Majlis podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Gandhara Podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Pakistan and Afghanistan from local perspective. And the podcast is published in every second week on Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Gandhara website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. But first, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast, we are discussing future of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in the light of its expansion. To discuss the topic, I am joined by Jacob Zen, non-resident research fellow at the China's Shanghai Cooperation Organization Study Center, Alex Melikishvili, senior Central Asia analyst at HIS Market Country Risk, Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlok Owozi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's blog focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, gentlemen. So let's start the discussion with a positive dream. In ideal world, Jacob, what's that Shanghai Cooperation Organization wants to achieve?
In an ideal world for themselves, which I don't think is ideal for the Western countries, the SCO would be an organization that can reach consensus on key issues of geopolitical importance, such as, say, what's going on in Syria. And at a time when the Western countries are pretty divided, especially NATO, the SCO could become the world's premier heavyweight international security organization and give a lot of weight to the positions of the countries in the SCO. And that's in particular China and Russia. And while China and Russia might have their own issues on certain areas of international affairs, when it comes to Ukraine, when it comes to Syria, when it comes to ISIS or Al-Qaeda, they're pretty much in line. And even bringing India and Pakistan in with them just helps adding numbers to it. And it is even possible that Iran could be elevated in the organization at one time. And Iran also sees eye to eye with Russia, especially today, given that Russia is inclined towards the so-called Shia bloc in the Middle East. So, I mean, based on numbers, based on power, based on nuclear weapons, based on geographic space, it has the potential, if it can keep unity, to become basically the world's biggest international security organization, even if it doesn't, at this point, have nearly the history of the alliance of NATO.
Do you think it's achieving that? It's at least on its way to achieve that ideal world that it wants?
I think it's a little too early to tell, but I think that it can be on its way because the Central Asian countries that are members, the STAN countries, are unlikely to disrupt any trajectory of this organization, except if they have internal squabbles. But I can see for the mid to long-term future, you know, China and Russia having very consistent positions on international affairs. And on those particular areas of geopolitical importance, India and Pakistan also going the same way with them. So I do think that it has that potential. But as I just mentioned, there's a lot of things that could hinder that, like internal squabbles between the STAN countries that derail the organization, or some Jammu Kashmir crisis that derails the India-Pakistan aspect. So there's some perhaps micro-level risks. But on the macro level, I think it's actually pretty optimistic for the organization.
I think, Alex, you are not optimistic about this. Jump in, please.
Yeah, I'd have to disagree because of the fact that we have to simply remember that India and Pakistan nearly went to war with each other a few times.
Three times.
A few times in relatively recent history. Mm-hmm. So I think the major test for the SCO, now that the India and Pakistan are inside, would be precisely that. Whether we would see, you know, I mean, first of all, you have to think about it from the point of view, if you are actually drawing a parallel with NATO, then you have to extend that parallel and think about what would be the comparison with the NATO with regard to Article 5, all for one and one for all. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but the you know, in SCO, there is not even a semblance of anything of the sort. And plus, we need to remember recent history. Let's take Uzbek-Kyrgyz ethnic violence in summer of 2010. Neither SCO nor CSTO, the Russian-led security grouping, had any reaction whatsoever to what was happening in the south of Kyrgyzstan. So I would say that SCO is largely in infancy in its development, and there are internal disagreements between major members, now India and Pakistan, that prevent it from developing further. Now, by all means, we'll soon see whether these major conflicts between major members, by the way, I have to say that none of the conflicts between Central Asian countries come even closer to India-Pakistan issue. So we'll see, I suppose, and fairly soon, whether SCO would be successful in resolving these major differences between the newly inducted members.
Bruce, I recall from our previous conversations that you have your own set of reservations about the effectiveness of this organization. Jump in, please.
Obviously, when you get these guys together and you got the leaders of, you know, Russia and China and India and Pakistan, you know, and then of course the countries from Central Asia, it looks formidable. There's no doubt about it. You know, that said, I was kind of surprised. I've been covering these guys since they started in 1996, and really the international media, it's been a busy week, admittedly, but they really didn't pay a lot of attention to what was going on in Astana today, which kind of shows that I think the world view is that they're maybe not as interesting as possible. But, you know, China in 1996, when they formed the Shanghai Five, and the big agreement was going to be that this was going to be a confidence building measure. They were going to move troops and military assets away from the common, what was the Soviet Chinese border, you know, and that seemed to work. At that time, when they did that, there was pretty much zero Chinese influence in Central Asia. Now, the Chinese have skillfully used the SCO to maneuver themselves into Central Asia economically, to the point where all the Central Asian states are economically dependent to a great extent on China and future funds coming out of China for projects that they want to implement. You know, OBOR is based on the success China had in Central Asia to a great degree. So I see when I watch and see China's moves, I see China actually losing interest in using the SCO as a vehicle for what they want in Central Asia and even on the subcontinent and in South Asia. You know, we'd heard that, of course, China formed this group with Pakistan, Afghanistan, Tajikistan that was, you know, based last year, you know, to address security concerns. Would that not have been better done within the framework of the SCO? I mean, Afghanistan is an observer country. Pakistan was an observer country. It got in today. But you could have done this within the SCO, but China went outside the SCO to do this. So, you know, I see China losing interest in this organization. When they have a conflict with the West, of course, they all get together. You have to pay attention to what they're saying. They're the leaders of huge countries with, you know, large militaries. So you got to pay some attention to them. But I don't see much cohesion there, and individual countries act on their own when they see that it's in their interest to do so, and they don't seem to consult with the SCO on a lot of matters that you would think they would if it was some kind of coherent organization.
Jacob, do you like to jump in? What Bruce just has said, like China probably losing interest and there is no cohesion within the membering countries. So what the future holds for this organization in this situation?
What Bruce said that resonated, and which I largely agree with, is that when it's sort of the SCO looking at the West, then they can likely present a somewhat unified front externally. And that's why having the number of Indians and Pakistanis as part of the organization probably helps. And largely that's rhetoric, even if, as Bruce said, the Western media hasn't paid much attention to what's going on in Astana. But internally, as far as we can see in the near to midterm future, it's likely not going to be a very efficient organization. So its strength is largely when you're talking about the SCO looking externally. Internally, there are probably a lot more effective internal mechanisms between countries that doesn't have to do with the rubric of the SCO that can solve problems. So if China has an issue with the border of Tajikistan and Afghanistan, it's probably much more efficient for China just to deal with those two countries on its own or add Pakistan. Or if Tajikistan and Uzbekistan have a water crisis, it probably makes a lot more sense for them to deal with it on their own and maybe with, say, Kazakhstan and Russia than to bring in, say, India and China. So I think internally it will likely plod along, but the SCO won't be used to solve many internal disputes or squabbles, but externally it can be strong. But I would also raise the issue that, you know, China is largely seen, correctly so, as the one who spearheaded this whole organization. So for it to sort of collapse or fail would be a major loss of face for China. So I do see a country like China putting in the resources to make sure that this organization keeps some momentum into the future and doesn't become some type of paper tiger organization.
But Jacob, it is not depend only on China, right? But when you look into this, Russia seems to be playing its own game in the organization. Like you have this CSO, and Russia has its own CSTO and CIS, and China has its OBOR. Russia has its own Eurasian Economic Union. There are lots of rival projects are going on in this region.
Yes, so one of the ideas I'm getting from this discussion, and that's sort of increasing my understanding, is that internally within the SCO space, countries are going to do whatever most efficient for them. And if that means ignoring the SCO and creating their own sub-institution, then that's what they'll do.
Then how it can work together?
Internally within the SCO space, it should not be considered a highly effective organization except for sharing ideas and creating a forum for the various countries to get together on an annual basis. But I think it is effective on an external basis where these countries, I think in the future, can present a solid platform when dealing on key issues of international affairs, say Syria or Ukraine. And we haven't really gotten there where the SCO has that big voice yet. But I think in the future that could develop. So I would make a dichotomy between the external and the internal effectiveness of the SCO, even if the external effectiveness is mostly in terms of rhetoric, and internally it's sort of a paper tiger.
Okay. Unfortunately, we have to conclude the discussion. To conclude, final arguments. So what future holds for this organization, Bruce, Alex, please feel free to jump in.
I would say that it will most likely continue on its current trajectory, where you have pro forma dialogue, where you have governments on different levels, including heads of state, getting together, discussing security issues, maybe, as Jacob pointed out, on issues that are not sort of existential for any of them. They would come up with some sort of common position, such as Syria, for instance, where you don't really have any vested major interests from any of them. But other than that, I don't see this, as of now, developing into a major military political alliance, even closely similar to NATO. And plus, you have to also take into account that you have CSTO. CSTO, the Russian-led security grouping, is far more institutionally developed and militarily developed. You know, so I can't compare Shanghai Cooperation Organization with Collective Security Treaty Organization at present. And it will be very interesting to see, just like you pointed out, that you have these sort of overlapping organizations. It will be very interesting to see how SCO and CSTO interact. What sort of interaction will be between them? Because obviously some of the functions are completely duplicated between them.
Okay, Bruce?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's going to go along. There is an advantage for these countries to be able to get together and present a common front if they feel that their collective interests or perhaps the interests of a few are threatened by something outside or there's something they object to outside. You know, I mean, the big example was when after the Andijan violence in May 2005, they had a Shanghai Cooperation Organization conference right after that. And all the members agreed, you know, that the U.S. was using a base in Hanabad in southern Uzbekistan, and Uzbekistan wanted them out. And so Uzbekistan turned to the SCO and they all said, yes, we want the U.S. to, present a timetable for when they're going to leave Uzbekistan. And I think that's probably going to be the greatest role that this group will play for at least the foreseeable future, is if they feel there's some kind of pressures from outside their region, the West, say, that then they would get together and make some kind of collective statement about we object to what's going on, or we don't agree with this or something. You know, I mean, I suppose it is among the members, it does provide something of a forum for them to get together and talk some of this out. I mean, there was endless reports yesterday in Russian media about how this would be an ideal opportunity for India and Pakistan to resolve their differences. Well, I don't, you know, we've already heard on this in this session that that's unlikely to happen. I don't think membership in the SCO is going to do anything to jumpstart India, Pakistani peace talks or resolve the problems that they have between them. But it in any case, it does mean that the leaders have to get together once a year in the same room, and hopefully they would get up, go off on the sidelines and talk about some of these things. So it could be useful in that respect, too.
Okay. Thank you very much for your insightful comments. Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Owozi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's blog, focusing on Central Asia. And big thanks to Jacob Zinn, a non-resident research fellow at the China's Shanghai Cooperation Organization Studies Center, and Alex Malekshvili, senior Central Asia analyst at the HIS Market Country Risk. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It was great to have you. And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.